Today on the Monocle Weekly, edition 96, we're back in London where we'll be looking ahead to this week's royal wedding.
If you step back and take into account the viewership worldwide, how much interest there is in foreign countries, it helps Britain overall in terms of tourism, image, possibly television advertising. So there must be an overall economic boost.
That was Gwen Robinson from the Financial Times. And following this week's Counter-Terror Expo in London, we'll be asking, how do you design terrorism-proof buildings that don't compromise on aesthetics?
Sort of to move away from the very obvious steel walls and bollards and to create an environment of standoff which isn't detrimental in a way that contributes to the design rather than detracts from it.
And later in the program, we'll be getting an update on the events surrounding the discovery of the Air France Flight 447 wreckage from David Gallo, Director of Special Projects at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution.
There's no real happy ending here. There's a certain amount of satisfaction that we've done our job properly, and we hope we can now get on to understanding what happened to that aircraft.
And now from London, the Monocle Weekly with Tyler Brûlé, Andrew Tuck and Robert Bound.
Hello, it's Sunday, April 24th, 2011, and you're with the Monocle Weekly back here in London. I'm Tyler Brûlé, along with Andrew Tuck and Rob Bound. And also the Easter Bunny's here. Did you notice? Big hit with this extra big headphones.
You can't see the ears in the headphones.
Wait till she takes them off. Also, the Easter Bunny's actually, it's a lady. It's a lady bunny. It's all out of context this week. Gwen Robinson is here from Tokyo for the Financial Times. Hello, Gwen.
Hi, Tyler. I hope you're not saying I'm the Easter Bunny.
Yeah,
I don't
have absolutely.
Big ears. My ears are fine, thank you.
Why are you in London, Gwen?
Well, I'm doing a bit of this and a bit of that, actually. Just dropping in to see head office and enjoy the sunshine.
They didn't rope you over to do the FT special wedding coverage.
That's a thought, actually. I suppose listeners might be able to tell from my accent that.
But I'm wondering whether there is a discussion at the FT. Is this next sort of 2 week period going to be good or bad for the UK economy? Because I think you speak to anyone who's resident in this town, it seems like everyone is splitting, or no one's particularly interested. And everyone who thought they were going to cash in because people from Arkansas and Auckland would be renting their houses to watch the wedding, that doesn't seem to be happening either. Andrew, what do you think?
I think actually all the hotels are going to be pretty full.
Did you rent your house out?
No, I didn't rent my house out because I wanted to be, actually, I'm quite happy to be here. It'd be it's a nice weekend, not because I'm going to go and see the real wedding. But no, I think the hotels are pretty full, and I think they've also ramped up their prices like crazy. As soon as they knew which was the weekend for the wedding, they kind of doubled their prices.
I think there's very many views of the whole thing, but really, if you step back and take into account all the tremendous, you know, the viewership worldwide, how much interest there is in foreign countries as well. I mean, I just came from Japan and there was already some hype. You know, I think it helps Britain overall in terms of tourism, image, possibly, you know, television advertising costs, things like that. So there must be an overall economic boost. And if you think back to Charles and Diana's wedding, I think that too was seen as a overall net gain for the British economy.
Mm. Rob, do you think this is really the official kickoff to the run-up to the Olympics as well then?
Yeah, definitely, which I'm looking forward to because in East London I can only really rent out my flat for the Olympics. I've got a kiln set up, I mean, to manufacture some sort of bad chinaware with sort of purposeful misspellings on for the royal wedding. So I'm sort of starting slowly and building up to the Olympics.
Mm. Yeah. But will you be out there with your bunting around the palace?
You know where I'm going to be.
Guess where we're going to be.
What do you think the time delay is going to be on that, by the way?
What time? Are we going to be just coming back from karaoke at that time, I think?
That's the best.
We're going to be in Seoul. Gwen, you can pop over if you want.
Gee, thanks.
Yeah. There's a bit of a Jeff Koons number happening in Seoul, so we'll be over there. Andrew, you can come too.
And we can all sing God Save the Queen.
Absolutely.
In honor.
No, it will be quite late, because what time is the wedding?
It's 11 a.m, isn't it?
But it starts even earlier than that. The coverage is quite interesting. That when they release the schedule, it's literally to the second. It's like 8:37 and 30 seconds they will be doing it here. So it starts at 8 o'clock in the morning.
I hope it's going to be sort of coolish because when was the Charles and Diana wedding? What month was that?
That was summer as well. It was a summer wedding. I remember.
It was summer. Was it a July wedding?
Because you know what? I came up from Bracknell. I came up from Bramwell and I spent the night on the Strand with my friends.
Did you?
Well, in fact, I was because I'm not that young, actually. I was already out of the Little Shorts by then.
You're dating yourself.
Or not back into the Little Shorts by then.
The Little Shorts returned again a few years later, but at that point I wasn't in the Little Shorts.
But I don't think I'd want to be one of the, well, not just US broadcasters, but you can see around the palace at the moment, they've got all of the, I mean, they really look like chicken coops for all of the networks, in front of the fountain. And it's, probably enough room for about three cameras and probably, two people who are presenting. And if it's sort of even a day like or some of the days earlier in this week, it'd be rather toasty.
I think. Indeed. And the irony is I've got quite a few friends who are foreign correspondents in London who have been trying to get passes to cover the wedding. But ridiculously, I mean, they've all concluded you'll see much more sitting at home looking at the television set.
Yeah.
I mean, you'd corralled and herded, and you'll see one little bit of it, and the crowds will be massive. So,
are the Japanese networks interested?
I think they're quite interested. It's very strange because the Japanese have been utterly bemused by the antics of the royal family in Britain for some time, let's say.
Because there's no antics at the imperial household, are there?
Yes, I think probably most of the listeners know that the imperial family of Japan is extremely staid and never do anything untoward. And so, there's been much bemusement about the royals here. And I think there's actually some intrigue about, I've seen some comments about how wholesome and happy Wills and Kate look. And the Japanese might be looking forward to a little bit of old-fashioned, proper romance, nice wedding, decent sort of behaviour.
Well, I guess, for Japan and I guess for karaoke hour for us, Rob, it will be primetime viewing, in fact. It'll be early evening, won't it?
Indeed, it's absolutely prime time. So
it's quite an interesting branding exercise as well. hold on.
Guess what sound this is? I'm not trying to drown you out, Andrew.
It's deafening, that.
It's not the Japanese Easter Bunny came. It's a Swiss Easter Bunny who came.
Okay.
Ben, pass these around.
They're the noisiest Easter eggs I've ever come across.
But these are little. Yeah. Anyway, happy Easter.
Thank you very much.
It's a little something for the flight home as well.
Thank you. I'll wiggle my ears. anticipation.
Andrew, do you think though that, and just going back to what I was asking Rob earlier about, this sort of being sort of the big run up period, do you almost think that there was some kind of planning to say that we actually sort of need an official kickoff date, not just for the Olympics, but Britain needs a bit of a 14-month boost, and do you think there was some kind of planning between number 10 and the palace and everyone else?
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's that deliberate, but I think they're certainly going to use it. And what I was just going to say about the branding thing, which is quite interesting, is that you can imagine for the kind of generation, for his father, like Charles, he's going to be kind of, it's like the new concept royals are coming up behind. There's this kind of new make of royal that we can't quite have yet. We're going to see them on display. They're coming a quite contemporary wedding.
They run on hydrogen, don't they?
Yeah, they're electric royals. But they're literally like the electric royals, and we can't have them yet for actually kind of, maybe 10, 20 years. And it's so strange that they're going to kind of make their parents and that generation look completely fuddy-duddy and not wanted. And that's the branding thing that's quite interesting, that I think the government realises, that there's a kind of a youthful couple here that they can push forward, and that actually kind of says something quite interesting about Britain at a time when, to be honest, lots of people are not that sure about what we're doing and where we're going.
Well, it's interesting how everyone is so interested in the dress. I was in Paris earlier in the week and visited a number of champagne houses. And there it's, what bubbles are they going to drink? And it was really interesting. We visited probably four or five champagne houses. And they said, about 6 months ago, the palace placed an order for 400 cases. Then you hear from someone else saying, yes, I think because they placed, an order for, 200 cases. I was like, 200 cases, that's going to be a very bad party. But aside from that, they said, well, that's just going to be sort of, the post-dinner toast. And then you actually sort of realize that everyone's got a royal warrant as well.
That's what I was going to say, that everyone seems to have a royal warrant.
Yeah, it's true.
Mum. Yeah. I've got like a bit of mum.
Yeah.
That's got a royal warrant.
Krug has one as well. Yeah.
Veuve Clicquot has a royal warrant.
I think Laurent Perrier has one as well, I think.
Laurent Perrier.
So you think it's a concerted effort to spread the largesse and sort of keep good relations with, what's the purpose of that?
Yeah, I don't know if it's sort of Anglo-French relations or it's just, to remain well lubricated.
Yeah, I was going to say.
It's possibly the,
I think
the
discount obviously ran out on one and they went for another. I mean,
but it was funny also when you talk to some, because now some champagne houses also they don't wear them on their label. It's inside the box or it's on the reverse as well. Some have seen there's a bit of a liability. They wouldn't quite say that, but I'm just paraphrasing in French.
Nice eggs.
Yeah, they're good, aren't they?
I like the eggs.
Bloody good eggs.
So, Gwen, maybe we'll see. Should we let you go for your flight?
Well, thank you.
Yeah?
Yes, I could fly off.
Yeah, or you can stay around for another segment if you want to.
I might stick around.
You might stick around? Okay.
Particularly since I made the time. I might as well. And I could get another egg.
You could get another egg if you behave. We've got a very good segue, actually, for today's show because we're going to be talking about counterterrorism after this.
That's very nice.
Isn't that good?
Yeah, great. That's a great segue. Yes.
From eggs to explosives.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Oh, that's I think
that's a cue for a break. Yeah. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly pre-wedding Easter special here in London. Back after this. Back with Monocle Weekly here in London with me, Tyler Brûlé, Andrew Tuck, Rob Bound and Gwen Robinson visiting from the FT in Tokyo. Well, this week, London played host to the Counter Terror Expo, the largest international event of its kind for counterterrorism. Dozens of high-level seminars covering everything from cyber warfare to bioterrorism took place. But a prominent theme at this year's event was designing out terrorism, incorporating counterterrorism measures into architecture without compromising on aesthetics. Ruth Reid, president of the Royal Institute of British Architects, was a keynote speaker at the conference, and she now joins on the line to tell us more. Hello, Ruth.
Hello.
I guess to start, the positioning of this, the more barricades that you put up, the more blast walls, does that just make you a bigger target?
I think what it does is it heightens everybody's awareness to the threat, when in fact security actually means a feeling of security. In other words, one can go about one's normal business unhampered by defensive architecture and infrastructure. It's a way of integrating the very necessary measures into buildings and the surrounding landscape in a way that contributes to the design rather than detracts from it.
Mm. Do you think that, I guess to the layman, I would imagine most people think that, you know, the focus is the Saudi embassy, it's American embassies, it's British embassies, but it's considerably wider than that today when you think of what might be potential targets.
Yes, it is. And then one of the case studies that I used is the City of London, where the merchant banks are considered to be at risk. And obviously, sitting in an existing townscape, cityscape, they are less easy to protect than standalone buildings.
Mm. What, I guess, does it come down purely to architecture? And I guess, you know, there will still be a need for bollards or ones that emerge from pavements. Or is still a lot of this, you know, based on technology and really it's about good intelligence more than anything else?
There's many aspects to counterterrorism work, and some of them don't concern architects at all, and they are to do with intelligence and surveillance. But the aspects of the built environment, obviously, are the ones that we were concentrating on. And it's sort of to move away from the very obvious steel walls and bollards and to create an environment of standoff which isn't detrimental. So, for instance, in the City of London example, the streets have been pedestrianized so that vehicles carrying bombs can't get down them. Coincidental to that, it's created new open spaces for people working in the city to enjoy the fresh air. So it's had a positive benefit.
Was there any discussion about the situation with the U.S. Embassy? Of course, it's been a very hot topic that you know, became not only an eyesore, but it became a traffic headache sitting at the heart of W1. And, you know, some would say that the U.S. State Department is retreating by going south of the river. They're moving to a slightly inconvenient position and certainly not one which is, you know, many embassies, of course, they're there because they're just that. They're the representative of their nations. And of course, the U.S. had a very confident location. Now they move to another position in London. Do you think that's also a trend as well, that you know, many governments, many institutions say we just have to be somewhere simply, you know, that's different, slightly removed? It may not be very expressive of our brand, but safety comes first.
I would hesitate to call it a trend. I mean, every government in every location is going to take a view on risk. And clearly, the Americans felt that their situation in Grosvenor Square was highly risky to them and chose to move out to a site in which they could stand back from the public thoroughfares, which is fine, but it's not necessarily repeated. In areas in the world, clearly, governments are going to choose to be in defensible places if they think there's a real risk. But other places, producing blast-proof screening, preventing access by vehicles into the compound is sufficient. So in each time, it's on a case-by-case basis, and it's definitely got to be proportionate.
Mm. Ruth, hi, this is Rob in the studio with Tyler.
Hi.
I wondered how international this forum was, whether, you know, there were Americans' fears are different from Chinese or Japanese fears or Middle Eastern fears, and what are the targets that that other people are looking at protecting?
That wasn't played out in the room while I was there, but I did use international examples, particularly to do with the response to 9/11 and the redevelopment of Ground Zero, which is obviously has been the subject of an international competition and has gone through various iterations and now has a scheme that is basically about forgetting and moving on with obviously a remembrance part to it. But generally saying, you know, this is a resilient society. In downtown Manhattan, you can have corporate buildings and we will continue our lives as before, which is a very interesting message. As something that was so catastrophic, you one would believe that we would feel the scars and find that a difficult memory for a long time.
Ruth, it's Andrew here. I wanted to ask a question which is to do with the materials about what we make these things from. Because it strikes me that, you know, that we don't like these barricades and these blast walls because they're made from such hideous materials. But oddly, when you go to the city where you see one of these things you don't like, it's right next to the old Wall of London, which people love. You know, people love the idea of the walled city. And that was there for the same thing. It was there for defensive reasons. So
is it
materials that we don't like, or is it actually the very concept of a wall that defends us?
I don't think we have a problem with the idea of security. My example is what happens around St. Stephen's entrance to the Palace of Westminster and in that area there. I mean, in any other context, we wouldn't be allowed to do that to the setting of a Grade 1 listed building. So I think, you know, we're sensitive to the way it's being done, and at some point somebody's going to have to think about the road pattern and some kind of permanent solution that is less of an eyesore. It is the way it's done, the materials that it's done in, rather than the need for it, because we all understand that there is a need, and we like to know that people are taking proportionate steps towards reducing danger to Mother of Parliaments or in the case of the walls, heritage asset.
Ruth, it's Gwen Robinson here from the FT. I'm normally based in Japan, so I suppose what was uppermost in my mind listening to you was about talking about security of buildings, but we've just had the experience of the enormous earthquake and tidal wave of March 11th. And shortly before that, I suppose, we saw what happened in Christchurch with the earthquake to a lot of the central business district. So I was just wondering if there was any, in the conference, do you think there's a convergence in interests when you're talking about design and materials with protection from natural disasters as well as terrorism? Because I presume at some levels the impact of a huge bomb could be quite similar to the impact of an enormous tremor.
Yes, in some structures, and in particularly glazing, allowing for the failure of glazing in a way that it doesn't create shards that are going to injure laminated glass, for instance. I mean, that is a similar response. I mean, in designing buildings, architects are constantly playing off all the different requirements, some of which are catastrophic and others are the requirements of access and providing the space and facilities that the client wants from the building. So they do sort of come together, but they're not necessarily under the same umbrella. But there's a good synergy, particularly with glazing and the framework holding it, between being shook violently by an earthquake and being shook violently by a bomb.
Ruth Reed, President of the Royal Institute of British Architects, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. One of the more interesting counterterrorism exercises I've seen, and this was actually in the Marunouchi district, Gwen, in Tokyo, was I was just waiting outside a building. And of course, you know that, you know, it's a financial district and there are a lot of Westerners working there. But I guess sort of the particular stretch of Otemachi that I was in, the policeman came up and it was sort of a civilian brigade, and they had armbands, and maybe they were kind of sort of these civvy police, and they gave me a pack of Kleenex. And it on the reverse of the Kleenex, on sort of the little piece of packaging, it said how to spot a terrorist. This was an exercise about 18 months ago. So I'm not sure if they were sort of warning me off, thinking because I was sort of potentially the rogue gaijin in the neighborhood. But I thought only in Japan could you sort of potentially solve, you know, problems of, you know, international terrorism with a bit of Kleenex.
Yes, I think that's brilliant. Do you think they were trying to send you a message?
I think they were trying to send me a message.
They're on your case.
Absolutely. Would you be scared, Rob?
Was it then that you looked in the mirror and found a bit of scrambled egg in the beard?
Probably some toothpaste, more likely. You're listening to Monocle Weekly. We're in London. We're back after this. Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly here in London. Well, almost 2 years after Air France Flight 447 disappeared into the Atlantic, the search team has finally discovered the wreckage 6 miles north of the last known position of the Airbus A330. David Gallo from Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution has been heading up the search operation. He was on our program some weeks ago, and he joins us on the line again to give us an update. Hello, David.
Hi, how are you?
Well, the last time we spoke, it sounded, and we were certainly speaking off the back of that interview, that there was a slight tone of confidence, not overconfidence, certainly. But by the time you were in position, how long did it take for you to find certainly the main piece of fuselage that, of course, hit the world's front pages and TV screens?
About 1 week from the time that the first vehicle went in and until there was confirmation via pictures taken of the objects on the seafloor that was Air France 447, so about a week's time. Mm.
And upon the discovery, and I guess, you know, you have to read a lot of certainly trade titles and a lot of other journals, because, you know, certainly there's, you know, there was obviously much relief that that you found the wreckage, but, you know, still in the major global dailies there hasn't been a lot of detail. But I'm wondering if we could go into that to some degree. I mean, how big of a debris field are you looking at the moment, and do you feel that everything is there, or could there be something sort of sitting also another 40 kilometers away?
Sure. The total debris field's about on the air in the vicinity of about 600 by 200 meters. The team surveyed as planned that once we identified the first bit of aircraft that we would look far and wide to be sure that we had everything. We're very confident that within that area, 600 by 200 meters, is pretty much everything. Mm.
And what happens at this point? Do you, with the vessel that was sent down, does that stay in position until the, I guess, you know, now it's a salvage operation at this point, until the next vessel gets into position?
We use three autonomous vehicles, robots, to make the maps, and in fact produce some very detailed maps, both using sonar and then with cameras. Almost 100,000 images of that site were turned over to the BEA, the French agency responsible for the location of the aircraft. And then that has all been turned over to the Phase 5 team, Phoenix International. Phoenix International is the team that will be out there. And in fact, it's a little bit, I wouldn't call it salvage, but their goal is to recover the flight recorders. And they're very good at doing that. All of that information has gone to them, and soon they'll be on their way to the site. And I think within a week's time, they'll begin work at that site. Mm.
I don't want to turn you into a betting man, but obviously last time I said there was a different tone of confidence. But one would imagine that if the field is that contained, that I guess the black boxes are normally in the tail of the fuselage, correct?
That's correct. And I'm very confident, as I was before, that Phoenix International is among the best. There's no better group. This is what they do. And we've given them now the playing field, so to speak, or the very detailed maps that they're not accustomed to having that kind of detail to work from. So I think they're in a good position to produce positive results in a fairly short bit of time. It all goes well. We have to, again, hope, like before, we have to hope for the equipment to work properly and the weather to cooperate. But I'm fairly confident that they'll have success.
Who ultimately is the client in this situation? Is it the BEA? Is it Air France, or is it Airbus?
Well, I believe in our case, locating the aircraft, the BEA was the agency responsible. The expedition itself was funded by Air France and Airbus. But I think the client, in a way, is the French justice system. I would think that that's the last stop, because they're the ones that will have to decide what happened. BEA is going to want to know, will be the agency that will put the whole story together. But I think it's become a safety investigation at this point. So I think that they're really the client.
Mm. Last time we spoke, David, you had been with some of the families in France just weeks before. And I'm wondering, when you were in position, I guess you have to call it editing, what types of editing and you know, what was the filter in terms of releasing some images and not others?
Well, all of our images went again to the BEA. It's their responsibility, and they're really the official interface with the family organizations and the families, so it's their responsibility. And as I said before, there's no real happy ending here. There's a certain amount of satisfaction that we've done our job properly, and we hope we can now get on to understanding what happened to that aircraft.
Mm. And finally, just before we go, will they just solely be looking for the black boxes and bring these to the surface, or will they look to actually bring everything to the surface and move forward with some type of reconstruction as well?
I do know they have a list of priorities that have to do with recovering the black boxes and then maybe looking at one or two elements of the aircraft on the seafloor to try to understand what may have happened, you know, to the aircraft. But I don't believe that they're talking about major salvage operations at this point.
David Gallo from Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Thanks very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. We're in London. We're back after this. You're back with the Monocle Weekly here in London, where it's time for a bit of culture. It's time for some dueling CDs, Rob.
We should have a sort of some mariachi music. We should have some High Noon music, shouldn't we, for that?
We could. I've got something quite, I've something quite dramatic for you, though. This is just in anticipation of our trip to Seoul. I think we've talked about this movie before, The Man from Nowhere, starring our friend Won Bin.
That sounds very spooky already.
Yeah. No, it's very good. Gwen, I think you're a fan, aren't you?
Well, I'm a huge fan.
In the Olympus campaign. But you haven't seen the film yet, have you?
No.
Okay, no, you have to curl up, and it's a little
exactly,
bit of a...
If I finally call you to lend it to me.
But I think also you could get it down the street. I think they've got it at Tsutaya. I think you can rent it there, I'm pretty sure.
English subtitles, that's the trouble in Japan.
Yeah, but you know, I think they probably only do one edition. Mm. Anyway, the song is called Dear. This is the title track from the movie, and it's performed by a group called Mad Soul Child. That was Dear, My Dear.
That's very good indeed.
Mm.
It's a real proper Diane Warren power, sort of power ballad.
Yeah, it's big. And I think when you hear it on the super-duper Korean Dolby surround sound.
Yeah, I like it. I like all that. Mm. What scene in the movie is that? It sounds like someone driving away from someone else in a car with the windscreen wipers on.
With their hand dragging.
Exactly.
It is a Korean film, so it is. Be a seven hand.
Something's missing, definitely. What do you have?
I've got something Australian.
Mm.
It's a Kiwi based in Australia.
Is that not because Gwen's a Kiwi, but is it just because of the celebration of Gwen being here?
It's just a happenstance.
It is.
It's just
a happy.
It's a bit of serendipity.
Before we go to that, though, this is, have you seen Bobby the Bunny?
That's
this
nice.
Is this is also part of Lynn's collection, and this is just something a little special for you.
Thank you very much. That's excellent.
Do you want to just pass that around, but don't intercept it.
I'm not going to eat Bobby.
Don't.
Bobby the Bunny.
Is that cute?
That's brilliant.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, I didn't used to like eating the ones that actually were in the shape of animals in case they died.
Right.
Mm. I'm not a vegetarian anymore. I've got over that,
clearly.
Luckily. But yeah.
But it's funny. There's like a kind of a crayon sketch of Bobby the Bunny on the cover. And he's sort of looking back in terror. Do you think he's actually being chased by the Koreans?
Well, he's being chased by Bunny Boiler, I should imagine, and we won't mention any names as to who that might be. But he's being followed by a bird, anyway.
Exactly.
I think it's a dove, though. Do you want to know about
our Kiwi Aussies?
I don't know whether we should need that anymore. We've got Bobby the Bunny, we've got the Korean music.
Yeah, you don't need it. Go for it.
It's Lanu. is the name of the group, and the man is called Lance Ferguson. Lanu. It sounds like a sort of bit of a, it sounds a bit like
oh,
a
Lanu.
Lanu.
Oh, oh Lanu.
Sorry, that doesn't really cut out.
It doesn't. It? Oh, right. Sounds like it a real, sounds like an annoying Australian contraction of a perfectly good word.
No, yeah. It sounds Maori, actually.
Does it?
Lanu, yeah. Lanu.
Right. And they sound like this.
Those Kiwi Aussies know what they're doing.
It's very nice, isn't it? Perfect pop music. It's lovely. Yeah. If that were to soundtrack a bit of a movie, what would be happening in that bit of the movie?
Oh, Andrew, you first.
I think that's skipping along a beach, actually.
Yeah.
They're very happy.
Oh, I'm not feeling beach for that. I'm feeling sort of, I don't know, tree-lined lane. Bicycles.
Tree-lined lane? That's very specific.
Yeah, there might be poplars.
Okay.
Yeah. Gwen?
Oh, I think it's got to be swaggering along Bondi Beach with sort of, you know, a gelato in the hand and holding hands maybe. Something
it's like a sort of semi-erotic pillow fight.
Do you think? Get that one.
Sorry, that's what it said to me. That's the only reason I played it.
That's every song, isn't it, Rob?
That can be. Yeah, exactly.
And now we're not sending you back to Bondi, but you're heading back to the... I was going to say the mean streets of Tokyo. They're not mean at all. I mean... God, goodness
well,
gracious.
No, they're not. In fact, they're sort of getting more ebullient by the day. I think that's a kind of reaction probably to all the sort of gloom and doom and fear before. So it's day by day, it's getting more and more manic.
Really. I have to say, the French were very, very defensive when I was there this week because, I mean, a couple of them took issue with the fact that I said that the Frenchies were still in hiding. I don't see anything wrong with that because they were all in Paris anyway. So, but no, it was interesting though that you know we've touched on it here, but it's certainly on my page in the FT as well. There's been some rather sharp letters from French readers who didn't like.
What did they most take exception to?
Well, they just said that. Well, I didn't leave.
Right.
I was like, yeah, but you know, 5,500 others did.
Yeah, it's very. It's fascinating.
And it is because when we were with with Shikata-san from the Japanese government, the cabinet office, he didn't quite name them. There wasn't a name and shame. That wouldn't really happen in Japan. But he put on a French accent almost, didn't he? No.
I think. But indeed, it was. It's a really a very sensitive issue. It's becoming more and more sensitive. Mm. I think. Fascinating, especially in the workspace. There's a lot of investment banks and companies in Tokyo where people who left, as you quite rightly dubbed them in your column recently, the flygins, the play on the word gaijin for foreigners, that have come back. Quite a few have told me that their Japanese colleagues won't talk to them or they feel differently. They're being treated differently, which is curious.
Yeah, and different type of behavior as well.
Mm. So I actually waited at least a full sort of 5 weeks or 6 weeks to leave.
To leave, exactly.
Make it very clear that I've only left for 5 days, I'm back.
But that was the other side of it, though, is, you know, when you talk to a lot of the champagne companies, you know, they're just expecting that they'll probably have a, you know, maybe a flat year. They might even have growth in Japan as well, because, you know, some of the top ones, Japan's the number one market still. So you know they still it's remarkable, and it's usually UK, USA, and Japan all jockeying for the top position
for champagne sales.
For champagne sales,
that's interesting. Yeah. And also, I wouldn't anything could happen at the moment in Japan. It wouldn't surprise me if champagne sales went through the roof.
Yeah.
Or if they sort of crashed
fell
down.
Off a cliff,
You just can't tell. I mean, it's sort of a weird atmosphere where anything could happen.
And there was one conversation with one company. There was, you know, how do you grow the market? Because, you know, so much of it is still, and this is amazing when you talk about the volume, is that it is still hostess bar based as well.
Right.
And I mean, I said, well, how do you get a new generation of Japanese consumers? You know, how do you also sort of upsell them on something else as well, which is interesting.
Indeed, because I can say with all confidence that I think the hostess bar industry took a bit of a hit after March 11th. They're still sort of trying, they're still hurting, but... I think young people are obviously back out trying to party away their fears and woes and cheer themselves up. So, you know, there's obviously a big opportunity there.
Yeah, Rob, you know we need to go after this program though. There's we have to go and look at that little space near our office. There is supposed to be there is a secret basement underneath a restaurant, which has 40 seats, which I think has hostess and host bar written all over it.
I'll do the casting if you will.
Oh, you're going to set one up, the Monocle host bar.
I think it'd be great. Well, both. We can do both.
Oh, well. Right? ambidextrous.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's good, no?
Ambidextrous. It's a good word for it.
Yeah. We specialise in that.
Yes. Well, I think you could develop that idea quite well.
I think they're calling your Easter flight home.
Yeah, I think so.
I don't want to rush you out of the studio.
Break up the fun, no. Yeah. I think I really better
we're
head
gonna,
back.
And we also have to sort of clear the seat for the other Easter bunnies
exactly.
coming in. Hugo McDonald here in the next segment. But Gwen, thanks very much.
Thanks a lot, and sayonara.
Yeah, see you in Tokyo.
See you in Tokyo.
Okay,
bye.
Thanks. You're listening to Monocle Weekly, back after this. Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly. What's this sound?
Chocolate.
It is chocolate. That's the sound of Hugo McDonald.
I think every time he's on the show from now on, his first word should always be chocolate.
Chocolate. Did you see we've got a Bobby the Bunny over there at that end of the table?
Yes, I did.
Yeah.
And I like the picture on the front.
We don't have a Hugo the hare, sorry.
Oh, wow.
Okay, so you're back from Milan.
Yes.
You didn't come back by train like last year? No ash clouds?
It was a very smooth return journey this year. And it was a very hot fare.
Mm-hmm. In all ways?
In some ways. Well, weather-wise was what I was meaning specifically.
Right. Hot designers?
No, actually. A bit of a dearth of good-looking, younger, emerging designers.
Right.
Emerging designers.
Not that you were looking.
No, I wasn't. I was actually in the trade fair, sort of looking at business, not looking at the people, really.
Okay, well, in the pre-briefing for this segment, we said that we wanted 10 trends in 3 minutes. So what are they? Hit the clock, Rob. seriously.
Okay, seriously. I think the most interesting thing that's come out of it is the brands that are really spending their money very carefully. And suddenly it's very noticeable that brands have money to spend. And
that's not just in the form of advertising pages?
No.
This means what, R&D? Are you talking
R&D
the size of my stand is bigger than your stand?
No, it's not all about show. It's actually much more about sort of clever diversifying into different areas. So there are brands that are now looking at outdoor furniture that have never done that before.
Mm-hmm.
Brands looking to sort of enter new, maybe sort of mid-range price categories for the first time. Brands that are looking at the crossover between the domestic and contract market.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody was very willing to sort of speak about the fact that what they've learned over the past couple of years is that they can't just rely on a heritage of 50 years of great furniture making. They need to really sort of access new markets, be that geographical or
Are these all good
financial.
Things, though?
I think so, definitely. I mean, it sounds, sort of when you talk about the fair and say there was a lot of contract furniture and a lot of outdoor furniture,
right.
Maybe it doesn't sound very exciting. But actually, I think it's a good news for the industry. And something that I know you're very keen on.
What, outdoor furniture? We're kind of sorted. Did you like the shipment earlier in the week?
Love the bouncy chairs.
Yeah.
They're actually very comfortable.
The Grythyttan, they're very nice, aren't they?
Beautiful. The packaging was very nice.
The packaging was nice. You could have built yourself a little cardboard house. There was so much cardboard that came down from Sweden. And also there's the nice deck chairs from Dorset.
Yeah, which are also beautiful.
Dorset
I love
Beach.
The deck chair. I love the attitude the deck chair puts you in as soon as you're in it.
Yeah.
Something about that specific slopiness and the swing of the canvas that you sit in that makes you in a great mood, whatever the weather.
I think you need a full sitting room just of deck chairs.
Imagine like a get mad bus, isn't it?
Get rid of our office chairs. Just have deck chairs.
Exactly. Okay, let's go back to Milan.
Yes, gone are the big statement showpieces that I think brands made in the last few years and tended to hide behind to try and sort of put on a brave face and show that they were still making exceptional furniture.
And what about the big statement designer names? Did you feel this year that were, because I know obviously you had your sort of rant and tanty in the run up to Milan just about the sheer volume of press releases and checkups that were coming your way, but with a lot of it in the form that okay, you know we've signed whether it's this emerging student or it's you know Antonio Citterio doing something yet again, or did the brands want to stand really on their own 2 feet on the merits of their design?
There's still a plethora of these big name designers, and you can't really move without seeing something by Patrizia Urquiola, who was mobbed at the fair.
Really? She was mobbed?
Well, she was mobbed. I saw her coming out of the door with a gaggle of like 30 people, like Madonna leaving a concert or something.
Oh, wow.
And it was quite a sight. But, I mean, actually...
my chair.
I know, it is. It's a bit of a circus still surrounding these top 15 designers. And, I mean, I think brands still do play it safe in terms of who they want to put as the name on their stand.
And what about visitors? You know, obviously we've, you know, we said that, and you touched on it. I think when you were at Cologne as well, sort of looking at what was happening with the Chinese. Did you feel it when we look at emerging markets? That, you know, were there a lot of Chinese, Thai? Did you have a lot of Portuguese from our Brazilian friends? Or?
Yes, there was a lot of Brazilians and also Indians. I noticed for the first time.
Right.
And apparently, India is a very big market for outdoor furniture. And this is talking
it's warm,
about.
It's warm though. You'd need covers for it, wouldn't you, Andrew? It's quite damp as well.
Yes, you need to know how to look after it.
I'm intrigued about. I don't want to be cynical, but you know, if you're in the business of making sectional units, then and you know, of course, if we look at sort of all of these emerging markets. That yes, they have rather large homes, you know, in Brazil and India. It's a bit of a given, isn't it, that you're going to just say, well, we're going to, you know, do it in mesh, and you can put them out on the terrace.
Absolutely. Well, it's surprising that it's taken this long, really, for brands to wake up and move in that direction.
Right.
But it seems that maybe with that little bit more money that they have to spend this year, that's where they're putting it.
I wonder if there was, like, maybe Rob, if there was actually sort of a board meeting, you know, on the part of one of these private equity companies saying, listen, you know, warming planet, gentlemen around the table, don't you think we should do outdoor furniture? You think that's what happened?
Might be, yeah, exactly. And no roofs on houses.
Yeah.
Retractable, like Wimbledon, like centre court.
Yes.
If there were three things...
trying to put him off.
If there were three things that you would want in your house, what would they be?
There was a very beautiful sofa designed by Christophe Pillet for Chakotay, which to me is sort of the most exciting thing I saw, actually. It's very, very nice walnut, made half by machine and half by hand. And that to me was a very...
I thought you were going to say sort of exotic animal or something. It's like...
half by ocelot.
Yeah, exactly. What else?
Some very beautiful hand-blown glass lights by Michele De Lucchi.
Mm-hmm.
And
blown by what?
Have a chocolate.
Whales. and finally, I mean, Jasper Morrison's new collection for Maroonie was really very beautiful indeed as well.
We like Maroonie.
So simple. I know we really do. And we love Jasper Morrison as well.
Anyone who comes to our office and has to wait probably more than 1 minute gets to sit in the Maroonie furniture downstairs.
I quite like taking a trip down there to sit in them myself.
Do you? I haven't seen that happen. I guess I've been on the road too long.
I wonder where he's gone to. Where's he gone?
And if there were three stinkers at the show.
Oh God! Don't get me.
Do you think they'd look at nice at Andrew's house?
There were quite a few stinkers.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, the biggest debate, which is actually quite interesting, that's come out of the fair though, is that designers don't earn any money.
That designers don't.
Yeah. I mean, bar those 15.
Okay.
Because
Patricia Urquell is doing all right.
She's doing fine. And yes, like I say, there's this 15 who are obviously making a very healthy living. But young designers and even designers who have 10 products launching at the fair, you know, they don't make anything other than royalties. Mm. And quite often these products are shown on the stands, but then they don't go into production.
Right.
And so all these designers have gathered together for the first time and have had a bit of a shout out saying, this isn't really fair that you make us work to put this prototype together and then it can win awards and everything, but you never put it into production.
But we get bugger
all. We don't
all.
Get anything for it. Yeah.
Protests on the streets?
Protests on...
Could be coming.
Well, I don't know. It's on the internet at the moment, so...
All right.
It could develop into something physical.
Well, we can all tune into the internet, can't we, Andrew?
We can. But also, in this issue, there's quite a good thing with the How I Manage story about the people who run Knoll.
Mm.
There was a really kind of interesting aside in there where they were talking about kind of developing a chair with a company that they developed for 2 years. And then, you know, all for good reasons, they decided it wasn't different enough from what they already had in their kind of portfolio and that they wouldn't put it into production. But that's an amazing amount of time for a design team to be working on something for 2 years as an outside collaborator that then never, ever gets made.
That's very good to hear because there's just so much furniture that is launched and it feels like there's just too much now. And somebody said something very interesting that Ira Saarinen only ever designed 6 chairs and they're all still in production. And Konstantin Gritschich launched 6 chairs at the fair.
Right.
And it's just a mark on how swollen the industry is with things.
Oh, that doesn't sound very nice, a swollen industry.
swollen emerging markets.
Yes, exactly. I think we should go take a break and we should maybe sort of end with an Easter song. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly in London on Easter Sunday. We're back in a moment. welcome back to the Monocle Weekly in London, where it's almost time to say goodbye. Rob, you don't have any foil between your teeth, I hope. Isn't that an awful feeling?
Oh, imagine that, like nails on a blackboard.
Oh, it's worse. I think biting onto a bit of foil is just
biting
awful.
On wool and pulling a wool jumper out of your teeth slowly. It's fine.
Oh, really?
Why do you do that of an evening?
I don't know. I used to torment myself as a child with all those Aran jumpers up in Scotland.
Really?
Yeah.
You know, I used to eat the woolen balls off of sweaters. Ugh. Yeah, my mom said sometimes, you know, I was sort of like, you know, 9 months or something, I would pick them off the blanket and she would like sort of see, just, I'd been gumming a whole mouthful of woolen balls.
Are you still coughing up fur balls?
Something like that. I want to know a little bit about Scottish Easter.
My mother's favourite flowers are primroses, and so she goes out and gathers them in bunches. I was going to be called Primrose if I was a girl, actually.
So, Hugo. I don't know where that really leaves us, Andrew, do you?
That's almost too much information, actually.
Yeah. And what about the cousins or the nephews?
The nephews. Yeah, they just gorge themselves on chocolate.
And go mental. They run around and go crazy.
Fat, waddly stage at the moment.
Yeah. Oh, are they?
Yeah, they are.
Oh, God.
It's quite cute, but getting a bit gross.
Goodness. And Rob, are you off to Sunday lunch now?
Yeah, Sussex. Sussex Easter. That means Simnel cake.
Right.
It's got a Bobby the Bunny on the Simnel cake, actually.
Absolutely.
Always standing to attention. And some nice marzipan balls.
Perfect. Mm. Andrew? What? Just go with it.
No, I've got no ball references to throw in here.
Okay, good.
I'm going to stay in my short shorts and...
And play with your eggs. Yeah. Good. Excellent. Anyway, that's all for this week's edition of the Monocle Weekly. Today's show was produced by Alex Mills. Our sound engineer was Chris Sharp here at the Sound Company in London. And if you have any thoughts or comments for today's show, then do drop us a note to weekly@monocle.com. And remember, you can catch up with us daily via our monocolumn. Just don't sue us. Andrew, also, we didn't plug our new issue. Just before we go,
I was trying to do that.
No, there was a good segue. It was so subtle though that I missed it almost.
And then you
went
moved
right
on.
Over Rob's head. I know we did. Okay, so we have the lovely story about Noel, which is not in the design section. It's in our business section.
Good. For how I manage, we have a very good coverage. I think of Japan and Japan Inc. and the coming months, years, and about what the nation needs to do to rebuild, rebrand, and reposition itself, you know, on a global stage with politics, through small business, and through kind of both using its kind of heritage and its more contemporary kind of design attributes to, you know, rebuild the nation.
Did you write the press release?
That was quite good, wasn't it?
It was very good. God, you could actually be a spokesperson for the Japanese government. They're looking for someone right now. And Rob, what was in your section? We like the NHK story very
NHK
much.
NHK was good.
This issue's a bit broadcast-tastic. I think there was a bit of a land grab on your section as well. Because,
well, I've had words with Steve about this.
Yeah, because it's a big Al Jazeera story. But we've had him off the show for about, 2 weeks now. Mm. We'll see if Steve Bloomfield makes a return.
I've got him in Ankara.
Oh, do you?
That's where I've sent
That's
him.
Where he is today?
Yes.
Oh, good.
He's at Ankara.
he's listing
portside in Ankara.
Anyway, yeah, the edition is on newsstands pretty much all over Europe, almost all over the world at this point.
And also Design Directory and Barcelona Guide as well.
As well. You're absolutely right. Anyway, next week we are in London. But for now, I'm Tyler Brulé.
I'm Andrew Tuck.
I'm Robert Band.
I'm Hugo MacDonald.
Have a very happy Easter. To play us out, here is Dear Again. This is by Mad Soulchild. Oh, you can.